in terms of our program, we have two openings. Got two openings. Is that what time is it now? It's 10 to 5. You can get to a bus at 6, or you can get to a bus at 8. So that's the time you have. That's my practical arrangement, which actually I've got. So I thought it will be good when we start the session that at least you actually know that I do actually have a stopwatch, and I can work on that. Depending on how you feel and how you use your time, you have two options, and which I think is actually quite viable. Okay, you're comfortable with that. I'm sure you're happy. Okay. That arrangement is quite good. We can be able to do that. You can take your car in the bus. Can we then actually maybe thank the presentation? Deputy Minister, thanks very much, and the DGs and the A-team. One was actually just thinking what will be the best approach, because maybe we can actually under-explain the day tomorrow in terms of actually what the program will be looking like, so that when we start now, we are able to actually package that into the concluding part, which will be tomorrow. Andre?
Chair, tomorrow we'll get a full briefing by the NRCS and SAPS on the annual report and the first quarter report. So, and the DG and his team will also be present tomorrow through that engagement. So I would assume that the issues that are the NRC and SAPS can also be addressed tomorrow when they are actually present here to answer all the questions. That's what the 6 o'clock bus, if people want to know that. And so we're also, in light of the bus story, we're also trying to see if we can't get the other service provider for transport services, but we only have an answer about that in a half an hour time. But the chances are that may not happen. So the 6 o'clock bus and 8 o'clock bus is the only options that would be available to members. But for the program for tomorrow is SAPS and NRCS, just to inform members about that.
We're starting at 9:30. And should we finish at about lunchtime? Mm-hmm. Yeah, tomorrow morning. Okay. So I think I'll actually just invite the Deputy Minister, maybe at the way of agreeing on how we actually proceed, because we do actually have our presentations done. And I was actually hoping, in the order that we have actually made the presentation, maybe start the process of actually getting to point of clarity if ever there are questions. But I think on those two entities, the simple suggestion is just to say it will be good that we engage on that tomorrow, because there will be representatives of entities as well present in the meeting, which I think it will add more value other than actually engaging in the absence. Yeah. So, Jim?
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think that's a good directive. For now, we are comfortable. We can take both departments. Anyway, we are one. We're saying if the honorable members, when they ask, they can or comment in any of the presentation. We'll see to it how we handle it. So we really want to demonstrate that we are moving towards merging the two departments. So, yeah. We are open to that.
I'm sure, because for tomorrow, the program we have, we're going to have the briefing by the SABS, same 2018-19 annual report and first quarter. And then after tea time, before lunch, we'll actually have the NRCS same. So I think those will be the two areas which I think we can consider. So which means for those areas there will be sufficient time to engage. It links directly to the AG's report and the kind of progress we're making and challenges that we might be facing in that space. So can we actually then agree that we will actually follow the order of the presentation that we actually have had, because that will make things easier, to actually just say that from the DTI presentation, if ever they actually commence questions, we'll actually pick up from that. Once we're done on that part, then actually pick up on the EDD side, so that we actually don't mix the two. And by the end of the day, there should be one story end of the day that we're talking about the department. So the floor is...
I have a different view, Chair.
Okay, let's hear the view.
We appeal that you allow us to pose questions to both departments, and we not be restricted to ask DTI now and then later EDD, because the deputy minister says they are one department. So the DGs will be able to separate the questions directed at each other. I'm just appealing, Chairperson.
No, because I would say second language, but I don't think there's any difference. So you say you're ready to ask questions, because that's what the honourable members are saying. We're ready to ask questions. Chairperson, can you just allow us to do that? And the time is now. If ever the members would like to raise a point, let me start. Raj and Yaku, you're not going to ask any questions. I'm just checking. No, it's six and eight. Yeah. If you didn't have an answer to your question, that might be a problem. And then three, okay. And then McPherson, and then we take in that order. So can we actually proceed in that way? Yako?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be sweet and short. I just wanted to ask, the DG spoke about, for EDD, he spoke about steel and the steel companies and all the manufacturing companies that you are engaging with, and that with the issue that you have as municipalities. And I know in Nelson Mandela we had an issue there where basically they were called high energy users, and they would hold the municipality hostage to say that because of the billing system that's not working in the municipality, so they would say we're owing this much, but actually the fault is with your billing system. So we're going to have to shed jobs if you then demand us to pay electricity, or you know what I mean. So then it would impact, because now we have to beg for them to say, no, okay, let's pay in installments instead of them paying what's owed. So is there no way of reaching perhaps an agreement with, say, Eskom to say that this is how much you're going to pay and the tariffs that you're going to pay that are going to then accommodate and not impact our municipalities? Because sometimes the municipalities have systems that are not quite as accurate or quite as efficient as you would say on a provincial or national level, if you then want to grow the economy and not having to beg them for an opportunity to work in your space, basically.
Yeah. Baba Mulda, I think I did tell you what time it is. You're fine. And Trin?
Thank you, Chair. I will try to be as brief as I can. The first one is on beneficiation. Could we have some kind of, could I get some kind of feedback with regards to how large is this, the beneficiation, particularly within the steel industry that was mentioned? How large is, how many jobs have been created? And then secondly, South Africa being a mineral-rich country, what are the other areas of beneficiation that we could be utilizing and capitalizing on that we are not, that could be creating jobs that we are not, but we do have an intention to do so? That's on beneficiation. Secondly, there's been a newspaper report on Morendi Properties. Apparently, the owners of this particular business black industrialists were promised $14.2 million a grant in October 2017, and DGI has, according to the newspaper report, has failed to grant that particular grant, to give that particular grant. What is the process? Because it certainly doesn't make DGI look good, where the Pretoria High Court has ruled that they ought to be given that particular grant. That's trade and industry, EDD. The funds and penalties collected by your competition tribunal, it goes into the fiscus. I have a problem with that. Very often where there's unfair practices, it's the consumer that gets hurt. It's the consumer that gets ripped off. But the money doesn't go back to the consumer. The money goes into the general fiscus and it gets swallowed up. So I'm just making a point that I think that really it should benefit the consumer that had been ripped off by whichever company it was. The poor maintenance, I think the poultry, I think it was Goldie and Astral, the two poultry industries that were affected by the poor infrastructure. Interested to hear what kind of negotiations you entered into with the local government in those particular areas to ensure that those particular companies, because of poor infrastructure at a local government level, what kind of interactions you had to ensure that. Did you step in? Did you assist local government? Did you give them money? What did you do to ensure that those businesses did not go under? And then finally, I spoke to a farmer, because you mentioned something in the report about water tanks that are also being utilized. But I spoke to a farmer who said that there are some water pumps that will cost maybe about $20,000, $50,000 to repair. But they have not been repaired. And instead, we have water tankers that take water to the local people requiring water on a daily basis. And that particular cost is astronomical as compared to fixing a water pump that may be about 50,000 rand. And this is also happening at a local government level. So the challenge that we have with infrastructure and the impact that it also has on the economy, particularly the local economy, is huge. So again, I think it's the interaction with local government to ensure that on the area of infrastructure development, we are not selling ourselves short. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is on DTA. DGA says a sizable amount of incentive investment is in Gauteng at 3.6 billion. This is understandable given the fact that the Gauteng is our economic hub. But how do we use incentives to decentralized economic growth in our provinces? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. How effective is the awareness campaigns or workshops, especially with regard to the black economist, black industrialist incentives in the rural areas? Secondly, does the department target potential industrialist, or is awareness open to all, and how effective is it?
Okay, thank you, Chair. Let me first welcome the presentation. And Chair, just clarity on few issues here. One will be the rural and the township economy, education and awareness program. Do we have as EDD or whether the DTI? And in terms of achievement, are we able to roam around the provinces and be able to provide that education and awareness? Secondly, in the incentives and and the tax, because we are talking of transformation programs, specific the women and the youth. Can you be able to finish with a list of those companies that are able to benefit, those beneficiaries, so that we know exactly how are they benefiting and who are those companies? Chair, the last one, we have the challenge with the localization. I don't know, because the challenge is when it's in the technical sector. We just want to check as to whether do you have a program that seeks to alleviate or educate government, more especially local government and the provincial government, in terms of localization, and the localization in terms of the procurement of issues of specific goods that are designated for localization. Then the last one, Chair. Yeah? Oh, okay. No, I'm not vis-a-vis. Chair, the turnaround strategy in terms of the DTI vis-a-vis those entities that we have had challenges. So can we at least be finished with it? Maybe if it's not today, tomorrow, the strategy sector. The two entities, we had the presentation, NCRS and the SABS, so that we have a turnaround strategy, given the fact that they are downing the industry or the department. So what do you want to do to turn around the situation so that we move as a department? I will pause there for now, Chairperson, but if given a chance, I will ask a question in terms of the integration of the NEF and the CIFA to be the IDC to be one department. Because really, if you can see, Chair, to be one entity. Yeah, because there's also the Steel Fund, the Tirisano Fund, the PCICC Fund. There are a lot of funds in the EDD. So I don't know if we can channel those funds to various departments, because there's tourism fund. We can give them to the tourism department so that they work with those tourism day to day. There's the Tirisano Fund that deals with construction, while the Department of Public Works dealing with. Are we not duplicating works? I just wanted to check. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The Deputy Minister taught me something new today. I had no idea that South Africa had a thriving pottery industry. So thanks for enlightening me on that. And hopefully when, as we come from the same province, you'll be able to show me these new pottery industries that you had referred to in your speech. DG, with regards to the film sector that you spoke passionately about, in my engagements with the Western Cape government, they are experiencing severe problems with getting projects approved for people who want to film and produce in the Western Cape and in South Africa, because of A, the cap issue, and two, there's just seems to be a slowness and just, well, not enough money to actually work with these incentives. Now, when is the department going to relook and revisit the film requirements and film policy within the department? Because it seems to be rather outdated. And I was speaking to one company. They want to do a $50 million production in South Africa, and there's just simply no willingness or no appetite from the department to make it work. And there seems to be a view now in the department to how do we find reasons to not make something happen as opposed to finding the reasons to make things happen. And I would hope that we lean towards making or finding reasons to make things happen. With regards to the Job Creation Trust, I had highlighted to yourself and to the department in June of this year in June of this year, that there was a company called Creative Designs, which is owned by a number of unions and employs 300 people. They had been granted 24 million rand by the Job Creation Fund, and yet only 12 million rand had been paid out to them. Now, through the department spokesperson, he had said that the final payment would be paid by the end of July. That amount has still not been paid, and they are now approaching the High Court next week for liquidation, which will put 300 people onto the street. How is it possible that something like that can happen? That an amount which was granted, an amount which was promised to be paid to a company, and a date in which a promise has been made, has not been fulfilled, and that company will now be liquidated, costing 300 people their jobs. If you can take me through that and help me understand. I put a question to the minister with regards to industrial parks. We are now approaching half a billion rand that's been spent on industrial parks. And in his response to me, he admitted that there is not a single agreement with any local or provincial authority to offer rebates of any sort. When is that going to be finalized? Because for as long as those rebates do not exist, there is not going to be any further investment into those parks. And I know that there's not any corporate investment into the parks because the minister himself had no idea if anyone had actually invested any money into the parks. With respect to the IDC, I also asked the minister a question regarding politically exposed individuals who have been granted loans by the IDC. And there was one particular individual by the name of Mr. Tokyo Sokwale. It was Matthews Pauza. Maybe some of you may or may not know who he is. Was granted a loan for 105 million rand through a company that he is involved in early 2009 and has never paid a single cent back to the IDC for that loan. Will the DG make a list available of all politically exposed individuals who have been granted loans by the IDC and who have not paid them back in full or partially paid them back in full? I would like a commitment that such a document will be provided to this committee on all outstanding loans that have been written off by the IDC, and more particularly to politically exposed individuals. With respect to the Competition Commission, DG, you will know that that the 125 million rand for the budget review was set aside by the Commission and was placed on hold at the insistence of National Treasury because the forensic audit and investigation into the company in Zaba Zaba Attorneys has not been completed. And you and I know that the bulk, if not all, of irregular expenditure in the Competition Commission originates from these attorneys that have been paid hundreds of millions of rands for work that cannot be accounted for. Please can you tell me when that forensic investigation will be completed? Because as I understand, no money for investigation can be released until such time as that investigation has been concluded. I also want to caution the IDC being used as a bailout for businesses that can't operate in the current market. I think that if we go down the road of providing billions of rands to private enterprises under the guise of saving jobs, the IDC will become bankrupt in a matter of years. I think that it must be very, very cautious in the equity in which it takes in certain businesses. And for my mind, retail is a dying industry. And I cannot understand what logical or financial sense is made in taking equity or debt in a retail operation that has not turned a profit, certainly for the last couple of years. And so, DG, with that in respect, can you tell me what are the very strict parameters that are in place for the IDC to take debt or equity in businesses which are essentially bailouts?
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief, Chair. I think I'm intimidated by time.
Just ignore it.
Chair.
Don't be intimidated. I'll stand up for you.
Chair, I'm deeply worried and have a concern about the continuous audit reports from some of the entities of the department, in particular the SABS and NRCS. This has been happening over a period of time, and there's little or no improvement. I also have a question on what oversight has the department played when there is continuously vacancies in these entities. Chair, again, on page 20 of the presentation, there's a mention has been made of this document. First quarter, what? That the department, as we all know, that we all support the establishment of black industrialists. I want to go on record, Chair, to say the prerequisite of 30 million from poor people who want to establish or who want to become black industrialists is unfair. And I request that it be reviewed if we are really committed to establish black industrialists, lest we want fronting to continue. Again, I want to know how many jobs are expected to be created in the whole in the world project. Maybe let me stop there for now.
I'm sure you did, Mantasha, say you want to ask any question, but if you make reference, it will be easier for the response. To say,
no, what they presented, Chair.
No, I understand, but I'm just saying on my part, I can't understand your question, and I'm part of the meeting. If you say, no, in terms of the presentation, EGD, this page, this item, it works out easier, and then the DTI, this page, and then you can ask the question. It helps all of us so that we follow what's the discussion, but it's fine. We can actually then proceed to the next one. I'm sure they understand you, Mantash. Let me take you.
I hope they understand, Chair.
Chair, thank you very much to the department for the presentation. I just wanted to relate something very practical that we were told in our visit to the one-stop shop down the road. You know, and it's something that I think it's easy to solve. I don't know why we haven't solved it yet, because we have the MOU with CIPC, and we've managed to, like get a quick turnover in terms of processing applications. And yet, we were told that the biggest challenge to investment, international investment in the South African economy, is the challenge of home affairs. Now, if we are able to have that working relationship, that MOU with CIPC, what is so difficult for us to get that same seamless application and visa processing process for the one-stop shops and investments in general. Because what we were told is that when investors hear that it's going to take 3 months, or they leave for their money, they go somewhere else where it's easier to do business. And I think we must work very hard on the president's undertaking to cut the red tape and to improve, yeah, the ease of doing business with South Africa. Then when we look at unemployment numbers and employment numbers and jobs that are created, do we, when we invest in projects, do we actually have a target that we set in terms of how many jobs are going to be created, or is it just a consequence that of investing somewhere that eventually it's so many jobs? Because if we are saying that we are increasing jobs, but there's more people who are becoming unemployed, so surely our target should be doubled or tripled in terms of job creation with whatever money we are putting out there to grow the economy. And I want to almost ask that, can't we take some of the funds of that we're giving to Tirisano to go and build childcare centers at big businesses? We heard from Mr. Favey, I think the name is, that it's women who are entering the labor market and exiting the labor market, and I'm sure you'll find that it's related to childcare. But what I want to say is that these are like social impact projects, so why aren't we putting our money there? If you go and look at Tirisano, we're putting a lot of money there. I don't know if Tirisano is somebody's name or is it something that came from somewhere else, but we've been asking ourselves, who's this Tirisano? And I've actually went to Google it. It's working together in Sutu. Okay. But the Google didn't tell me that, ne? The Google told me about the mining sector and showed me who the trustees were and that it's only 25% black owned. So if we are putting so much money there, if you look at what has been presented to us, it is basic education. And then, of course, the bursaries, which is also education. But when you go look at what Tirisano is supposed to do, why, I know you're saying that they call for applications, but what are we doing as a department to put it out there, to spread the word, so that we can get other social projects in other sectors like sports fields, water and sanitation projects, healthcare facilities, etc. Because surely it's up to us. We shouldn't just leave it to chance if somebody's seeing something, if we're really serious about growing the economy. Then I want to just respond to the comment made by Mr. McPherson. If we are asking IDC to account for politically connected individuals, I'm not sure if that is an empirical category of persons, because where do you begin and where do you end? Shouldn't we then ask that you give us a report on all loans that were written off, maybe over R1 million or something like that, instead of using a subjective category as politically connected. I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear, you know, so that we use a more general and to give us a better idea. And we'll find the politically exposed people amongst them. Thank you, Chair.
Sorry, I just want to help the Honourable Herman. The term politically exposed person, or PEP, or PEP, is a financial sector defined category that all financial institutions have to take further scrutiny with respect to FICA-ing them, lending them money, etc. So it is not a term made up by myself. It's a term that every financial institution, including the IDC, understands and is required by FICA to scrutinise further, because they have a politically exposed background.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for that education.
Okay. In line with the competition amendment and also the triple BEE, if I can just be clarified in terms of the requirement for one to be a BEE beneficiary. Because they are talking of 30,000 vis-a-vis, but I wanted to check million. So I wanted to check whether are we still in technique, because here we must be able to grow the economy while we are creating jobs. But if one, for him or her to benefit to government, he must have a 30 million, then to us it's a very serious challenge. And also check the triple BEE, in terms of requirement, whether it's 51 black or whatsoever, because now we're talking of Tirisano with 25% black owned and the 75% it's white. So, but we are pumping money and so forth as government. I'm not sure. Clarity, that's why I'm asking, Chair. Thank you.
Maybe one would then request a Deputy Minister and the DGs, because I think the suggestion was actually looking at that when one is making an intervention to questions you ask, one was trying to check how you receive the presentation and what will be questions for clarity or comments from us, because we have just received the information. I would actually then say, Deputy Minister, I take it on the lighter note when the issue of pottery business, my person was saying, no, there's pottery thing. I said, oh, okay, maybe the Deputy Minister understand what he's talking about. But what actually defeats the process is when communication which doesn't relate to what is presented gets engaged in, because I just thought it will be important to questions to the minister. The minister is not here now. I'm not sure if ever we're going to be able to follow up through this meeting. In the absence of the minister, I'm sure, Deputy Minister, there might be some of the questions you may not actually have dealt with the detail directly. So I think it's quite important. But I think even the issue, it's case by case, DG. If ever there's an issue that comes up and there's a political issue that comes up of politically exposed individuals, there may be specific cases or report. I'm not sure, maybe you have received some of the information, the issue of forensic investigation and the use of the IDC as bailout. I'm just referring to what Honorable Member McPherson is actually raising, because in some cases, if a presentation is done and then we have an opportunity to comment and ask questions, it is actually to get more clarity or get more information about what actually the presentation is all about. But without actually having to decide for the deputy minister and the DGs. So I thought, because I'm my part as well, I'm part of the meeting, I thought I should be able to make sense of the comments that are actually coming through so that I can be able to help facilitate and guide the meeting, because it's quite important. But I think I would like just to then hand over to Deputy Minister and the DGs. I'm sure you've heard the comments and questions that actually have been asked by honorable members. We can then actually leave the floor to you to make comments and maybe clarify some of the issues raised. But just a general comment on my side to honorable members to say I thought it should be easier for me to understand what the discussion is all about. But if you have spoken outside the meeting, it's also okay. You can tell us if you want us to be part of the discussion of what you had outside this space. Thank you. Deputy Minister.
No, thank you very much, Chair. And as we are saying, Chairperson, there are definitely questions that have come up, which as we are discussing, they would need, definitely need us to have time to go and compile the report, like the issue of the loans that have not been paid. We have had that. It's something that we have to go back, the DGs, compile the list so that a committee can be furnished with the response. Also, with that one of that was raised by MacPherson, as to say he did not know of that industry. I'm in the dark, really. I'm not sure what is it that you are talking about, but we can engage, as he's saying, who are from one province, maybe. We can also visit that. I'm not sure, really, but, yeah, we are going to be taking it up.
Deputy Minister, I was just saying, then it invites us. Then I can say, can you ask him so that he can respond, because he introduced the issue,
okay,
so that we can understand what you're talking about.
Okay, no,
because, you know, you've decided to talk to each other in our presence, and then can we really try and understand, because you have chosen to use this space.
Okay.
Can you share with us as well, so that we have sense of what...
Maybe he will clarify, then we'll get into that. But also, when the two DGs will respond to the rest of the questions, but I also wanted to DG October, when you respond to the designated local products, as to say, how do we access them? There is a letter, DG, that I know when a I'm just making an example. When the province of the Western Cape have issued a counter a letter on how to procure on localization products that are locally produced, where they have put the threshold of saying it should be those businesses that you have got a business that is, they put a threshold of 30 million or 20 million. So the letter from the Treasury, when he was responding to that, has to say, when we talk localization, there is no threshold. So I think it will more clarify even the question that was coming from Honorable Mabuyane, as to say, are there any products and what is it that you are doing to make sure that those are the products that are being done. But let me give to DG Tom to start with the questions that were directed to you and your department, the EDD.
Chairperson, thank you very much to the members of the committee for those questions. I'll try to respond to those that relate directly to us. Now, if I don't answer adequately, perhaps we could still raise exactly the point that I've actually missed out. Now, the first question is the one that you actually asked the honorable member about the electricity problems between municipalities and with particularly with the steel industries. The steel industries, they use a lot of electricity. That problem though you say it is in Port Elizabeth, but you'll find it is across. Now, here at Mfuleni, Standerton. Now, Vanderbilt Park. You see that problem arose. Now, how we resolve that problem? you'll find that we brought in ESCOM, we brought in NERSA, because NERSA determines, NERSA, we brought in the Department of Energy, right? And over and above that, because that particular municipality is under Section 159, right now it's under administration, we brought in the Department of the Provincial, the Department of the Gauteng Economic Development, right, to resolve that problem. Now, the issue there is that because it cuts across, we had to find a general formula of how do you deal with these situations, because these municipalities, they don't pay over to ESCOM, right? They don't pay over to ESCOM. Now, with ESCOM, they have got their own challenges, right? But in spite of those challenges, we're able to find a reasonable, right, a guide as to exactly how the municipalities themselves they should, because it's important to both support, because these municipalities, they see revenue in the electricity tariff, right? But at the same time, those entities, as I said, they are backbone of the economy. In there, in those localities, many jobs, people, they come from those localities. Now, the attitude that says, no, we are not going to, right, we are not going to address this problem because we see revenue and all those things, and then these firms, some of them, they retrench, others they threaten to close down. So we had to find a balancing act between the entities, that is, which are the municipalities, and the firms. Right. Now, I'm happy to say that there is probably a solution that we've actually put in place, right? But these entities, they've got to apply to the ESCOM, right, as to exactly how that relief could actually, they could actually exploit the relief itself, right? Now, but I'm hoping here that yes, we have tested it there, right? We will see how in other jurisdictions how this problem presents itself. I'm not aware about that one of Port Elizabeth, but I believe that the formula that we have actually put in place, right, it is generic, and it should be able to address the similar problems that are there. And of course, because that municipality is under Section 159. We insisted to the Gauteng that themselves, they must find a way, even if it means cross-subsidizing, right? But they are looking into that because they do have their own challenges, right? Which may be a slightly different situation from other municipalities. With the poultry industry. Now, here I'm speaking specifically about what happened at the Lekwa municipality, right? Because at the Lekwa municipality, the problem there is a water problem. In other words, it's a utility problem, right? Again, there you have got a situation where you have got an industry that needs millions of liters per day, right, for their slaughtering, right? Now, because they slaughter many birds, right, in there, so they need a lot of water, right? And the amount of water that they need, that is needed, is even larger than what the community actually requires, probably per day. Now, then, in that situation, you have got. And in a company that is the gold, right? It's called the, I'm sure they will say the gold chickens. That's right. Now, gold chickens is a big firm, right? It's a big producer, Right. And being big, and as I indicated, it appoints people in that area, about 4,500 people.
Right.
Now, in that situation, you need to also to be able to balance. You cannot then say that we are not going to solve their problems because I've got to supply water, yes, to the community. Communities, they need that. You need to even to find this, to strike a balance. What we then did in engaging with the Goldie, Goldie is actually prepared, right, to finance the infrastructure, right. In fact, they actually indicated that themselves they could actually cross up the dice whatever infrastructure that is there, with about 10 million, right, towards that infrastructure. Now that was one problem, and then the problem we needed immediately water, right. Some of that the municipality was able to provide, but for the long term, right, we needed to find together with the municipality, the Department of the Water and Sanitation, the national one, we brought them in, right, because what we need for long term, you need a company that has got means to be able to extract water from the Vaal River themselves directly, right. But for them to do that, they need a license. And the license is not provided by a municipality. The license is provided by the national government. Now, we are in that phase two now that we look into the provision of that license. Right. Now, with the Competition Commission, right, the penalty is there, right, that goes to the National Revenue Fund. This member of Parliament, we have engaged with Treasury, right? Because remember that I indicated that when we appointed for the state of readiness to implement the new act, now I made a point there that we appointed a panel, right? A panel to actually to look into what is the best funding model for an entity like a Competition Commission, right? One of the issues that we looked at, right, it was also exactly around the money that actually goes to the revenue fund, right? Now, again, with the Treasury having the financial challenges in terms of its own streams, right, it becomes difficult to be able to say you take that huge money, right, and not form part of your fiscus, because that amount is a huge amount, right, if you look at the numbers that I actually outlined, right. So the point there, we agreed that it's important, because at the end of the day, that money, it gets appropriated. It gets appropriated, and it can be utilized for the purposes of what you call to benefit the consumers. Right. Now, Treasury themselves, they argue in that way, right, because they need the money. Now, we then agreed that as a way forward, let us, on that question that is asked MP McPherson, right, about the 125 million, right, which is a provisional allocation on condition certain things should happen. Now, we then discussed, right, what is the appropriate, we looked at other jurisdictions, right, because that phenomenon of a competition is not only here in South Africa. We've actually made a comparison with other jurisdictions, how other competition authorities are funded, right. We then arrived at how the funding of the Competition Commission should actually happen. But the point, as I indicated there, is that we arrived at a point where we say we need to retain the way in which they are being funded, right? The way that they are being funded, which is mainly grant, right? Which is mainly grant funding. Now, if it is grant funding, then the issue about the penalties, right? The penalties. it becomes, yes, it's a source, but the Treasury sees that as a source for the NRF. Right. So we have not succeeded in actually changing the model that we have at this point in time. Let me just take the point about the IDC, the exposed persons, right? Yes, that definition, that is a standard definition, right? And is actually known as you indicated that in the FICA, yes, they define what are the politically exposed persons. But however, right, remember that you did send a PQ to us, right? Especially a PQ, and you listed the people that you regard as politically exposed people. And we replied to that. And the specific person that you referred to, right, was amongst those people. And in there, where I'm sitting, I think that we did adequately respond to that question, right? If there is something that is still outstanding, Chairperson, I would actually ask that you actually clarify that. But we did answer, right? I remember that. I remember that PQ, right? It was running between ourselves and the entity, right? Now, and I'm saying that we've actually replied to that, but if there's still anything that is outstanding, probably individuals that you listed and perhaps you feel that was not adequate, and then we can still talk about that. Now, with the 125 million, right, as I say, it's a provisional allocation, on the conditions that, correctly as you make the point, that there is a forensic investigation that we conducted, right, following the points, the findings of the Auditor General about irregular expenditures. Now, including a transaction of the company that you were mentioning, right. Now, the point there is that Treasury, one of the things that they did is that when that investigation was about to be concluded, right, and then themselves, they say, they gave other the extension of scope of that investigation. Right, and that extension of scope is something that happened recently. I think you did again there. We did reply to yourselves to say that report is not ready, and that we are dealing with the extended scope as the Treasury is actually requiring. Right? When will that be ready? Right? Now, it's difficult to say when it will be ready. Right? But we have extended the scope, and the team who are doing this investigation, they have actually started. Even last week, we were actually discussing this process with themselves, right, as to exactly when they should actually start, because that amount of 125, yes, it is a provisional amount, but there is a budgetary process, right, which we are targeting somewhere in October. We were hoping that come that date, this investigation would have been clarified, but it's difficult to say when we will be able to clarify that, because we need a larger scope of all the transactions. For how many years? Not 1 year, not 2 years. I think it's three or four years going back, which becomes even a bigger exercise. Now, with the IDC financially distressed, I'm not aware of that unless we are specific of which of these entities that are financially distressed.
Edcon.
You mean Edgars? Mm-hmm. Right. Now, I could get into that detail, right? I could get into that detail, because remember that here we don't impose either to the IDC who to finance, because IDC is one of the few viable SOEs that we have as a country, and themselves, right, the risk, the financial risk, they've evaluated their financial risk, and based on the due diligence that is there, then they make a determination, right? Now, there is no external pressure that actually is put on them to finance any of these failing entities, right? Now, the specifics about the EDCON, now, I don't know whether that it's something that I could actually give details of. Of course, I don't have the details at this point in time. Now, but I don't know whether I could actually be able to give the details of the contractual arrangement that is there between the IDC and the third party, right? But as a principle themselves, you see that they are considering the financial risk. For instance, if you take the discussion, the point that Lionel was making, I think, I don't know whether it was here, Lionel, or the was name, in another meeting, where we were talking about the financing of the NEF, right? Because NEF becoming a subsidiary. Now, those are the issues that the IDC looks into, and then they say what is their view themselves. That if they are concerned, they will raise what are the specific concerns. Is that. So this is how thorough themselves are before they could actually provide any funding. You know, the hole in the wall, but I see the member of parliament is just working out how many jobs are created there. At the hole in the wall, there is 210 jobs that are targeted. Right, that is both the full-time and those that are under construction. Those that are full-time, there are about 65 jobs that are actually targeted, that are actually going to be created in that project. The Tirisano finds the social investors. Remember, I believe the presentation I indicated there that the 60 million of what they have is to fund the ablution facilities, right? Now, they do finance the social infrastructure, but however, themselves, they have got trustees. Trustees are also people outside, right, those entities. They make a determination of exactly on the guidelines of exactly how the money is actually going to be utilized. I think those are the points, unless there is something that I've just left out. Let me have a look at it.
Thanks. In terms of then, Chair, I think. Honourable Yako didn't have a question for me. I think she's saving her ammunition for SABS and NRCS tomorrow. And then Honourable Tring, I think had two questions. I think one, the important one of beneficiation. He asked, what are the value chains? Yes, there has been a mine in Pakisa where we've identified about five or six different value chains, from platinum to mining equipment to titanium to plastics and polypropylene and so on. Where DTI has mainly been focusing on, because we saw quick wins, is mining equipment, where, as you know, we've got massive capacity because of our history with mining, drilling equipment, machinery, excavation and so on, valley equipment. We've been working on the mining equipment, and there's the mining Mandela precinct that has been set up. And then the more interesting one is the platinum one. As you know, South Africa produces about 87% of the world's platinum, and with Zimbabwe we do 100%. We've actually just launched, after years of working to develop this value chain, because it's fuel cells that you can make. And we, for example, one of the first projects we did is we put up a fuel cell generator at the mining chamber's offices, so that we can show the mining houses that you can use fuel cell generated electricity. We've just launched now in the Dubai Trade Port the first foreign investor to produce fuel platinum fuel cells locally produced. So it's the first commercial plant, and so that's an important value chain. And the other one is obviously steel, where we have both iron ore and coal in great abundance in this country, and that's the basis for steel. But as you know, we'll be protecting those sectors. On Lutring, your second question was about Murendi property, and thanks for that question. This is a company that applied for the Black Industrialist Program, and as you heard when you saw the AG giving a report, we distribute over 7 billion rand to about 4,000 companies annually. And as you know, we must ensure that every one of that 7 or 8 billion is not fraudulent and goes to the right people. So obviously, as you can see, over the past 4 years, we've received clean audits. What we've put in place is a system of, one, proper due diligence. So, for example, besides giving the documentation, we have an independent inspectorate in the DTI where we do a factory visit before we do a payment. So that we can ensure that you say you're going to start a factory here, the factory exists, we see the machinery and equipment, we see the expansion and so on. So with this particular company, when we did the inspection, well, we got worried because they gave 3 different BEE certificates. And as you saw recently with Honorable McPherson's point with the BEE commission fronting, so that's usually a lead indicator if the BEE certificates are potentially fraudulent. Then we did a factory inspection. And then we saw the person claimed that they were manufacturing, and we found no manufacturing to the hardware store. They went to court. We, as I said, the matter is currently before the court because the court rejected on appeal. We opposed that judgment, which they got from a lower court. That judgment has been set aside. So we're refusing to make the payment, and as I said, they have to answer those questions about potential fraud. On the question then of Honorable Moashi, I think the question of how do we spread out the activities, as you see, obviously because Gauteng is the economic hub of the country, we see most of the incentives go there. So what we've put in place is a number of programs to spread the economic activity. So the one program has been the SEZ program, and as you can see now, those SEZs are located in all the provinces, for example, in the Eastern Cape, Limpopo. Every province has one now. Also, we've used the provision of grants. So, as I indicated, in East London, in Kuha, in KZN now, we have over 180 investors we've attracted into our special economic zones. And that is through a decentralization policy. And the second policy, as you say, is the industrial parks program, where we have about 30 parks now. All of those parks are in rural areas. Take Botshabelo in the Free State, 70 km out of Bloemfontein. That one we're working on. So that is our programs with regards to spreading the economic activity out of Gauteng. Honorable Mtau, the Black Industries Program, how does it work and how do we spread it to rural areas? Again, it's a new program. It's about 3 years old. We've got a strict criteria for the Black Industrialist Program, and there you must be majority black-owned. So that's the criteria. So you must be more than 50% black-owned or substantial black ownership. But it can't just be a company fronting and just taking on a BE for a minority partner. It must be a black-owned. We then try to spread it to all the areas by having agreements with the provinces for them to also identify potential black industrialists, and that's why we reported, for example, Mpumalanga, KZN. We have that where we can work with the ground. We're rolling that out even to the metros, where we work with municipalities where they can identify black industrialists. We have road shows on the Black Industrialist Program to ensure that there would, we're currently standing at about 140 Black Industrialists that we finance. We're going into the second phase, and this comes to on Buyani's point about the threshold. Before, it's not a, the 30 million is, we used to, they set the criteria is the investment must be of the value of 30 million. Because we wanted to create, as I said, we wanted to get industrialists to go from small, medium to large. And not keep BEE to small business. What now, after the success of the program, obviously they are what we call the baby BEIs. There are now companies coming in and they are reviewing that target to say it should be 10 million. So that we can even take smaller companies now to come into the program, and that's how we're growing. But we're definitely addressing that issue of the threshold, and it is under consideration. Anand Moyani, your other one was about, we'll give you the details about black-owned companies that have, how many comply, women-owned companies, youth-owned companies, and we'll supply you that. Oh, the very important one of localization. We've designated over the past few years about 24 products, which, for example, clothing, textile, and footwear is completely 100%. Every army uniform, every police uniform, every SAA uniform must be procured locally. We've used now and we've given the grant to Bureau of Standards, and as you know, you'll see tomorrow, our former DDG, Graf Strachan, is running it there. We've set up a verification center there for SABS to play the role of acting as a verifier, to do inspections, to see that they do the local content. And so that verification is one of the things, and it's part of his turnaround plan as well, is to set up a verification office at SABS. I think the general question, which I think will be in the doc tomorrow on, is the NLCS and SABS, and as I said, we will present those turnaround plans tomorrow. As I indicated, we had 13 institutions. We cleaned up 10. What we did to clean up those 10, in all of them, we've removed. If we do have a problem of slow performance, we fired the CEOs, we've removed the boards, and so on. So with these two now, we've done the same. NLCS board has been removed, and we've removed it permanently. We've also, because that's where the corruption starts, from the board, and then the CEO, they've had two CEOs, so now we've seconded, as I said, the current CEO is there for just over a year now, and that is to be turned around. And currently in SABS as well, we've done the cleanup. It's under administration. It's almost ready to come out of administration, but you'll have to assess that tomorrow around the turnaround strategy for SABS. But as I said, there is consequence management. Whenever we, even CIPC used to get a qualified audit and all that, they got clean audits now, but it's because we replaced the CFO or the management and so on. It looks like we're going to have to be a bit even more stepping rights now, because we want, like for example at NRCS, it's not only the CEO that we removed. There's now no CFO, there's no IT officer. We're going to ask, and the minister, there has been discussed that we actually second and we transfer officials into these entities for a while. For example, we did, there was one person from the Auditor General's office who worked very well, who applied for the job of a CFO at NRCS. They didn't get it through the application process. We're thinking one of the recommendations could be that if we have the powers, we can just second those officials, and then we can, rather than going through this sort of long process, but we need what they call step-in rights to be able to clean up the entities that are underperforming. Honorable McPherson, yes, the two issues. One is, as you indicated, the film sector, which we're very proud of, it employs tens of thousands of people now due to our incentive scheme. The problem we have there is, as you know, we get only, over the past few years, our budget has doubled since 9 years ago. We used to have a budget of 5 billion. We have a budget of close to 10 billion now. But over the past 3 years, there's been no increases to our incentive budget. There's actually been cuts. So they've cut our incentive programs. And all the new programs we've developed, for example, the Industrial Parks program, the Black Industrialist program, all of it, you didn't get 1 cent extra from Treasury. What we've had to do is to be creative, to redirect within our incentive programs
We have to fund the black industrialists and the industrial parks. So we're going to need help. And as I said, because of the importance of industrialization, and also we've shown now a track record of showing how we can use incentive to grow the auto industry, the film industry, the BPO. On this one, what we had to do is we had to introduce, because we only get about 300 million, we obviously, you can't have one company or two companies take up the whole 100 million. So we had to introduce a 50 million cap so that we share it more equitably. So that's the purpose of the cap for that. Because obviously you can have one or two productions taking up the full amount. So that's the, and also we had to introduce in the program, because before it was only foreign films. We've had to produce a local program for local filmmakers and local black filmmakers to enter the market. So we even have to spread that amount between Hollywood and between local producers. But as I said, the problem is not we don't have unlimited resources. We have to use that 7.8 billion to support 1.6 million manufacturing workers and so on. So that's on that. And then again, on the question of the jobs trust again, as you know, so the one mechanism to prevent fraud, because as you know, if you give out grants of 7 billion rand, everybody's going to try to capture the DTI, mm-hmm. because everybody wants that, and especially if you give grants. And the reason why we've been able to keep a clean record is, one, inspection, two, proper due diligence, and three, we pay in tranches. So we don't give you the full amount immediately, because then you run away with the money, there's nothing. And as somebody asked about how do you ensure you get the targets of employment, investment, so the first one you get easy, because we want you to get started. The second one we say, you said you're going to create so many jobs. Then 6 months later, a year later, if you want to go to the second tranche, we do another inspection and we check how have you performed. Now, under the one of the jobs trust, it's even more onerous because this was EU funding. So EU also, you must account for every cent you get from the European Union. And also, so we take extra care. So that program is overseen by both us and National Treasury. So Jobs Trust got their first grant and a number of companies, but their paperwork wasn't in order. When we did the inspection and Treasury did the inspection, they couldn't show the paperwork. And so in that one, Treasury held back the payments. But I think we also have in place what Monday mentioned. We have to, the DGs, the ministers, we can't get involved in those decisions. So what we've set up is adjudication committees, which sometimes have outside people on there from other agencies, but it's staff that adjudicate an application to see it's genuine, do you qualify, is it genuine, and so on. And then they make a decision to accept or reject your application. And then we have an appeal process, and sometimes we sit in appeal. But I can't overturn a decision. So if somebody says, no, you don't qualify, then we as a practice, we don't get involved in those independent decision-making. But that's all to preserve the integrity of the program, because as you know, what's going to happen is if, like with the other departments, if we have one major fraud in the DTI, we're going to lose our entire incentive program, and Treasury is going to do what they did to other departments. They just stop you, and as I said, and we've already got a track record, so we are very careful. But if you do get queries, you can send it to us, and then we can give you the details of what happened to a particular case. Then on the, I think the final one is, I think asked about the visas on Will Herbans. That's a very important question, because as you indicated, we've picked up more and more that is the real cause for many companies. When they have to build plants, they need to fly in engineers, they need a quick visa just for somebody like the Procter & Gamble factory. You need them to build the factory, which will create jobs. They can't get visas, and so on. We've now put in, actually, as you speak about it, at the Job Summit meeting on Monday, the president, he visited the Department of Home Affairs. He asked them to do a presentation. They did a presentation on how fast they're going to move to e-visas, like we did at CIPC. The trick with CIPC was everything is electronic now. There's no paper, and that's why you can register a company in half an hour, and with the banks. There's a proposal for them to move towards the e-visa system so that you can immediately, just from wherever you are, apply electronically, get an answer immediately or quickly, and so on. So, and as the Deputy Minister mentioned, we're rolling out master plans now for the rest of the economy. There is a tourism master plan. We have asked that that be one of the key deliverables in the tourism master plan, is that e-visas. And that, so your matter is getting the full attention, including from the President, also putting pressure on e-visas, e-passports. I think that covers most of it. I hope I have covered everybody. And if you do, you, at this hour, you won't, most of you won't notice it.
Thank you, Chair. No, thank you, Deputy. I need to say Deputy Chair. Thank you, Chairperson. I think the DGs have covered all the questions, except just to put an emphasis on the question which was saying, how do we assist? As we have said, we get into the municipality when we find that our investors' companies are in distress because of the infrastructure, maybe the aging one. In whatever intervention that we come up with, we make sure that municipalities are part of it. It's not that we go there and give the money to the municipality and say, build the pipes and whatnot. I think when UDG was saying, most of them, let me take an example, Nestle in Harrismith, it's having challenges to continue just because of the aging infrastructure, water that is not quality, that is not clean. The intervention that we do from our side is to go there, sit with the municipality, sit with the company, and, for an example, the company will say, we are prepared to build, we are prepared to give everything, because at the end of the day, we want to see our company functional. But what we want to make sure is that municipality is part of those negotiations, because at the end of the day, the infrastructure remains with the municipality. Whenever the company, whenever we have intervened and assisted, same thing we have done in KZN with USAPI. USAPI is having problems even to continue with the production just because of the electricity supply from Guadaguza municipality. USAPI is prepared to assist there. So bring the municipality. So sometimes that even understanding is to say, municipality, what is the role that you need to come in and play? Not that there is so much money that is needed from you, but it's for you to be part of the journey when the company, when the DTI is assisting. So that's most of the time the interventions that you are doing. Same thing when it comes to the question of how effective, how do we go all out there for education campaigns and so forth. With the roadshows that we are having, a lot of them, I can assure you, there are so much benefits that you are getting out of the roadshows just to interact with those SMMEs. Just to open up what are the benefits, what are the opportunities that are there within the department. And for us, when we go there, we make sure that we bring, when we talk of one-stop shop, that's exactly what we do. So that even those ones, we are all there, SARS is there, CIFA is there, IDC is there. So it becomes easy even from that crowd, from the people that you are addressing, whatever problems they are there, we are even in a position to resolve, if ever, or if you can't resolve them, open up for them to say, this is where you can get assistance, these are the opportunities that are there. So I think those are campaigns that the two departments are embarking on, are really assisting, more especially to go to the townships, to go to the rural areas where we have to expose them, because we will keep on lamenting and crying that we don't find these black industrialists, we don't find people getting into the economy. It's because sometimes they're not aware of what of the opportunities that are there. So I think it's one program that we're embarking on and opening up for the people. And I can assure you, if you can come to the department, the way the proposals, the inquiries that you get, you find that after you have visited that area, there's so many, you know, people are lighting up, they know what is there. Even if they don't know, they're even able to ask, what is it? How can I get in assistance? So I think it's one program where the department is embarking on trying to open up so that we open eyes to everyone to become to come to be the role players in the economy of the country. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. You have a minute? And we will be concluding after you.
Sure, and I just really need to assist the DG because it's really such an important issue. I don't know who's fed you the information, but it's wrong. The department, in its own words, have said and have admitted and conceded that the trust, having satisfied the internal processes and the external audit firm's processes, is entitled to the balance of the 12 million rand. This is in June. The department then went on to further to say, we are certain that Treasury is processing the funding request and should soon make a transfer to the department, after which we, the department, will then be able to conclude extension agreements with all qualifying projects. And it still hasn't been done. Can I just finish?
No, I said a minute.
Yeah, I'm like on about 35 seconds.
You've got your minute.
These guys are going to be liquidated next week, and 300 people are going to lose their jobs.
McPherson, you've got your minute. The issue raised is not an issue for discussion. It has to be followed through. This is what I actually thought would be. It's not very productive for our meeting because the member has got issues which he could raise directly with the DG, follow through. I don't know why all of us should be audience to an issue that he might have reported and followed through. He's got documents he reads from, and I think he can be able to engage with you directly. He's a member of this committee. You are here. You can talk. But I'm just saying it's actually a bit abusive that on our part, we don't know what you're reading. We don't know what you're talking about, and now we are all actually having to be part of that kind of discussion. Can we ask that? Can you speak to the DG after the meeting? Can you actually try and finalize that process that way? So I will just say you don't have to respond. And on my part, that I'll ask that for all the members, it will be very important. If there are issues you're dealing with the DG, with the minister, please don't use the committee. We don't have to be part of your audience. Because unless you report through the committee, then we can be able to engage and participate as well. So I'm just saying it will be quite okay that we do it that way. So we're concluding our meeting now. We have our bus for 6:30. And can we actually convene here? It's 9:30? E249 is New Wing. 9:30, we actually meeting there. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned. For transport, we're going to confirm for members 6:30.